Continuing, his home and office were searched, and bills for reinforced concrete were scrutinized with addresses where the material was to be delivered. At 64 Rue Ampère, Paris, a Monsieur Robert de la Motte Saint-Pierre had installed what he advertised as a, quote, center of healing, unquote, by suggestion, hypnotism, and the like. Suddenly, a group of men who seemed to be in no mood to be healed of anything invaded the healing center. They broke into the cellar, and Monsieur de la Motte Saint-Pierre had to explain what healing had to do with 24 modern machine guns of German make, which they found there. There was also what he called his garage in the same block. Here, the persistent visitors found walls of reinforced concrete, which, together with the openings in them, suggested a machine gun blockhouse more than a garage. At 37 Rue Ribera, Paris, there was a boarding house for unmistakably genteel elderly ladies. The rooms were furnished in the Baroque style of the period when the boarders there were young. The one strange note in the decoration was a heavily hooded male figure that was repeated as a sort of leitmotif throughout the house. Obviously, it meant something to the present proprietor, for it had been only recently introduced in the decoration. Later, it developed that it was the insignia of the Order of the Cagoular, or Hooded Ones. When police tried to explore the cellar of the boarding house, they had to smash through a bricked-up door and found themselves inside a subterranean fortress. It was full to the roof with crates containing cartridges for all kinds of firearms, from revolvers to machine guns. Important to the use of this place seemed to be a telephone and a radio transmitter, indicating that this was a storehouse subject to calls by telephone or shortwave radio. The Sûreté was accumulating addresses, and every visit yielded results. At the home of Monsieur and Madame Juchereau, J-U-C-H-E-R-E-A-U, whose lives seemed to be impeccable with middle-class respectability, the cellar was found to contain 400 hand grenades, 378 explosive cartridges, and 100,000 cartridges of calibers ranging from 13 millimeter. There were also revolvers, rifles, and 16 submachine guns, products of Italian and German armament makers Beretta and Schmeisser. What the police found most interesting here were two bombs of the same models as those which blew up the buildings in Rue de Presbourg and Rue de Boissier. On the 18th of November, police visited the shop of an antique dealer, Monsieur Mauler, M-A-U-L-E-R, in Rue Rothereau near the Odéon, a quarter mellow with bookshops and little art shops. Mollet's neighbors were accustomed to see wooden cases of all sizes and shapes delivered at the shop. They assumed they contained ancient sculpture, coppers, and brasses of the Far East, Chinese and Japanese antiques in which Monsieur Mollet seemed specially interested. The neighborhood was shocked, therefore, to see police descend on the antique shop with scant ceremony. There proved to be several cellars, one under the other. The police disturbed the dust-laden treasure house of antiquity and found rooms full of stock more utilitarian than ornamental. Specifically, they listed cases of cartridges and Schmeisser machine guns. By the way, I thought that was Schmeisser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-S-E-R. I may be wrong. It's spelled here as Schmesser, S-C-H-M-E-S-S-E-R. I don't know whether Golem is right or whether I'm correct in my memory. But in any case, it's a small point. Continuing. In addition, there were new uniforms enough to clothe whole companies of infantry. Monsieur Mollet and his sister were arrested. The lawyer they called, Monsieur Xavier Vallat, V-A-L-L-A-T, was a member of the Croix de Feu and a friend of Duke Pozzo di Borgio. A close associate of his was Jacques Doriot, head of the French Popular Party, which has as its program a frankly fascist rule for France and collaboration with Hitler. Other arsenals were uncovered in Paris, Caen, and Lyon. The whole map of France became dotted with such finds. Newspapers were read now by the French as though they were bulletins from a hospital where an exploratory operation was going on. On November 21st, Colonel de la Roque, leader, issued a public statement to his followers of the Croix de Feu, quote, "Prepare to be accused of storing arms and to be arrested. It seems to be the mode," unquote. Ostensibly, the tone was bitter complaint. Many, however, read it as a warning, quote, "Get rid of armament," unquote. And immediately after his statement, a new development rendered France almost hysterical. The papers now began to record stores of arms and ammunition no longer in hiding places, but hastily thrown out on highways, streets, in fields, in brooks. Cases of cartridges were found in the middle of a street in Lyon, packages of dynamite in a ditch at Valenciennes, label cartridges on the Montreux-en-Caux highway, an enormous arsenal in an abandoned quarry at Annay-sur-Marne. Children came home showing off neat, heavy boxes they had found somewhere. Parents became frantic, for the packages were crammed with explosives. Newspapers warned everybody not to touch strange finds. On January 26, 1937, the warning received grim confirmation. At Via Juif, police were carting away 6,000 grenades and 200 kilograms of explosives they had found in a Cagoulard arsenal. A policeman let slip his end of a wooden case. The ammunition blew up and took a toll of 14 lives. All France was asking, quote, who is behind all this, unquote. A partial answer came on November 23rd. For the first time, the government made public the name of an organization with which the hidden arsenals were linked. It was the Comité Secret d'Action Révolutionnaire. At once, its first letters, CSAR, made a word on everybody's lips. Interchangeable with it was Cagoulard, quote-unquote. After a report that at the meetings of this organization, members wore monk's cowls to hide their faces. Of course, this is one of the fascist organizations that François Mitterrand was very close to. Continuing, up to then, it was obvious that those arrested were only small fry in a big conspiracy. Then, on the same day that CSAR became a byword, the police announced the arrest of Monsieur Eugène Deloncle, D-E-L-O-N-C-L-E. That said something. He was a big industrialist, member of the Chamber of Commerce of Paris, formerly an engineer at the Penway Works, and head of the Maritime and River Transport Mortgage Company. The police charged that under the alias of Grosset, G-R-O-S-S-E-T, he was also one of the leaders of the Cagoulard. The accusation was so serious that it was made public by Monsieur Max Dormoy, D-O-R-M-O-Y, head of the Ministry of the Interior. Quote, investigations on the part of the Sûreté Nationale and the Prefecture of Police in the course of the last few weeks have uncovered a widespread plot against the republican institutions of our country. Stores of military material have been seized, most of it manufactured in other countries. Magazines, rifles, and machine guns, revolvers, hand grenades, cartridges, explosives in bulk, uniforms in quantity, war medical equipment, and the like have been found in hiding places all over France. Quote, a search of the main office of the Maritime and River Transport Mortgage Company, 78 Rue de Provence, the head of which, Eugène Deloncle, consulting engineer of the Penway Works, established the fact that there is in existence a secret, semi-military organization basing itself on force, that it consists of a general staff, espionage bureau, and a medical corps. The formation of its members into divisions, brigades, regiments, battalions, etc., shows indubitably the military character of this organization. Documents seized on the premises reveal that the objective of this organization is to substitute a regime of dictatorship in place of the republican form of our government. In addition to the above material found, there are also blank papers obviously intended for the manufacture of false passports, plans for the transport of armed troops, detailed information on the personnel and organization of the police departments of our principal cities, notepaper, and other stationery stolen from military establishments in our government, lists of buildings that have several exits and entrances, a detailed map of the sewers of Paris with indications how the Chamber of Deputies can be reached through them, plans of the interior of newspaper offices, facsimiles of the signatures of important ministers of our government, a list of high functionaries and parliamentarians to be arrested at a given signal, plans for the seizure of municipal buses and other means of city transport, plans for stealing arms and munitions from the arsenal at Mont-Valérien. So again, the Cagoulard, again this clandestine fascist organization whose members reportedly wore hoods, and were organized, again, in an underground cellular fashion. The Cagoulard were actually attempting to overthrow the Popular Front of Léon Blum, the democratically elected government of France, and to replace it with a fascist dictatorship. And this Cagoulard program of 37 and 38 was very similar to the American coup attempt of 1934 that I discussed in Radio Free America program number 10. We should also note that the organization of the Cagular is very similar to the clandestine organization of the German Nazi Party in Germany in the pre-World War II in the pre-World War II period, and as we shall see, is very similar to the organization of the post-World War II clandestine Nazi structure in Germany in the immediate post-World War II period, going right on up through today. What we're going to take a look at next is a description of the actual cellular organization of the Cagular. Returning to Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum. How many CSIRists or Cagular there were remains a matter of speculation. The Sûreté Nationale listed 18,000 members. Other estimates went as high as 100,000. The locations of their fortresses showed strategy. They were so placed that they would command areas of military importance. All that was necessary would be to blow down a wall that hid the fortresses, and some public square or much-used crossroad, a government building, or barracks would be exposed to batteries of guns. Cagular cells or units were designated as, quote, heavy or, quote, light, unquote. A light cell consisted of 8 men equipped with rifles, automatic revolvers, hand grenades, and a submachine gun. A heavy cell had 12 men, and in addition to the armament of a light cell, also had a machine gun. 3 to 5 cells formed a unit. 3 units made a battalion. 3 battalions a regiment. 2 regiments a brigade. And 2 brigades formed a division of 2,000 men. A battalion consisted of 150 men, subdivided into squads of 50 to 60 men, and had 10 to 12 armored cars. A handbook was printed for use by group leaders. To avoid disaster should a copy fall into wrong hands, the book was entitled Secret Instructions, Communist Party. A characteristic excerpt taught technique in street fighting, quote, "The special force for street combat is our infantry, armed with automatic revolvers and hand grenades. Street squads should be supplied with submachine guns, hand grenades, revolvers, and petar for blowing in doors. If a door is barricaded, crowbars or explosives are to be used. Should the door be too heavy for either, a motor lorry should be driven against it. When mopping up basements and cellars, effective use can be made of bombs thrown down manholes and other openings after your men have gained near enough access. In mopping upper stories, our men ascending the stairs should keep close to the walls, while others of the detachments should keep firing straight up the stairwell. In this manner, the building can be mopped up floor by floor. Sometimes it is effective to skip a floor, then break a hole in the ceiling, and mop up by throwing hand grenades down on those resisting below." So again, note the basic organizational and operational methodology of the Cagular. Basically, they were organized into small cells, obviously very heavily armed, which could be merged into larger groups, and they were literally conducting a clandestine program of subversion against the French government. This was an actual abortive coup attempt. And as we shall see, the hand pulling the strings of these French fascists, these domestic fascists in France, were fascists from Germany and Italy, who were essentially pulling the strings of the French fascists and utilizing them in much the same fashion that the German fascists had organized themselves and deliberately subverted the Weimar Republic from within. And again, we should note that the Weimar Republic was subverted to a large extent as the result of a covert program of political assassinations organized by dissident elements of the German military, many of which later became affiliated with the Nazis. Continuing with Joseph Gollum's descriptions and talking about Joseph Gollum's account here and talking about the German and Italian alliances of the Cagular. Gollum writes in Armies of Spies, "Meanwhile, German names began to crop up in CSIR investigations. A Teutonic blonde, Elsa Schwartz, was mistress to Jacques Percheron, member of the CSIR and head of several of its arsenals. Franz Hassenfuss was concierge, that's H-A-S-E-N-F-U-S, was concierge of a building where the police found a store of Schmeisser machine guns, Beretta magazine rifles, and scores of thousands of hand grenades and cartridges. Jean-Georges Viard, W-I-A-R-T, of German origin, instructed CSIR classes in the use of Schmeisser guns. The ramifications of the Cagular's conspiracy, therefore, went far outside of France, and its story is not ended. Nevertheless, in spite of evidence, circumstantial and direct, against rank and file of the CSAR and their leaders, only 100 of the former are kept in prison at the time of writing, awaiting trial. Of the leaders, practically all were released from custody. This meant either that the evidence against them was not important, or that there was another and highly important reason. That the latter was the case was indicated by the chief of the Sûreté Nationale to reporters who asked searching questions about the release of CSAR suspects. "Gentlemen," said the official gravely, "this affair is too serious for us to discuss any further at this time," unquote. The gentlemen of the press understood. With tension between France on the one hand and Germany and Italy on the other, a revelation that Germany and Italy were storing arms and ammunition all over France might set off bigger arsenals than those of the CSAR. Nevertheless, it was clear that Germany and Italy contributed heavily to CSAR arsenals. Most of the guns were of German make, the ammunition, Italian. Dr. Kling, K-L-I-N-G, head of the Paris Police Laboratory, found, for instance, that the explosives CSAR used in bombs were tolite and hexagene. Both were developed by an Italian chemist, are produced by Italian patent, and are leased outside of Italy only to Germany under special and exclusive contracts. There is the further fact that both in Germany and Italy, the manufacture and distribution of arms and ammunition are strictly under government control. It would be too much to say that CSAR activities and the Etoile bomb explosions were as much the work of foreigners' torpedoes as the murder of the Roselli brothers. The majority of CSAR members are French citizens. Two of the best-known journalists in France, Léon Belby and Deputy de Carilis, even defended the CSARists. Belby wrote, quote, "If we must charge the Delancres and the Duseigneurs with CSAR conspiracy, for conspiracy there is, they can be accused only of wishing to defend their country in their own fashion." Monsieur de Carilis' defense was, quote, "There is evidence, of course, of foreign conspiracy in the CSAR affair, but it is a case of good Frenchmen wishing to defend their country against revolution, falling into the hands of German and Italian agents who, for their own ends, at a given signal, plan to launch in our country a bloody civil war," unquote. Good Frenchmen are bad, foreign torpedoes and termites work on them. So note again that the participants, for the most part, in the Cagoulard coup attempt and the Cagoulard movement were French fascists who were embittered at the social front, the popular front of Léon Blum, and they much preferred the prospects of a fascist government than one of a democratic government involving socialists. Later, as we shall see, after the failure of the Cagoulard coup attempt, despite the great assistance given to it by Germany and Italy, who basically financed and armed much of the fascist Cagoulard movement, many of the Cagoulard collaborated with the Germans in helping to subvert France during the time of the German invasion in 1940, and many of the Cagoulard elements later became key, very prominent in the Vichy fascist collaborationist government, which followed the fall of France. We're going to talk about the evolution of this French fascist movement, this fifth column, and we're going to see how ultimately the French fascist of the Cagoulard, intimates apparently at one time of François Mitterrand, we're going to see how they collaborated with the Germans to actually effect the defeat of France, and later we're going to see in the organizational methodology of the contemporary Nazi elements in Germany, as well as Nazi elements in Austria, a direct reflection of the clandestine political warfare, the espionage methodology developed by Adolf Hitler for his German fascism, and we're going to see a direct echo, a direct reflection of the underground cellular organization of the Cagoulard as well. However, we're going to take a look at that after a musical break. By the way, we may not have time to complete all of the information or to get to all of the information I had scheduled for this evening. If that's the case, I will finish up the information for tonight's prepared portion during next week's broadcast. But music, and then more of the prepared portion of tonight's program. We're going to continue now with tonight's program, Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. One of the things that we have been looking at concerns the Cagoulard movement. That was a fascist political movement in France based on a cellular underground organization in which French fascist sympathizers opposed to the social front or the popular front of Léon Blum actually attempted to stage a fascist coup. This fascist movement was underwritten and supported to a large extent by the Germans and Italians. Basically, it represented a fifth column movement within France, but it's worth noting that most of the members of this group were French reactionaries who professed that they were acting out of a sense of patriotism. They basically felt much more comfortable with fascism than with a democratically elected government involving socialists of their own nationality. As we have seen in our examination of the Cagoulard movement, it represented a classic manifestation of the Hitlerian methodology of underground cellular organization and of using a combination of psychological warfare and clandestine military action to effect a takeover. That methodology was not new to Adolf Hitler, but he formalized it and refined it. And that methodology for a fascist subversion is essentially the same whether one is attempting to subvert one's own country or a neighbor's. The methodological organization of fascist subversion for German fascism was the same whether German Nazism was organizing to subvert the democracy in its own country, the Weimar Republic, or whether it was conspiring to subvert the democracies in neighboring countries. And that same basic operational methodology of using clandestine cells in order to largely escape recognition, that same methodology is in effect today in Germany, Austria, and elsewhere. It obviously worked to a certain extent in Italy as well, where the P2 Lodge finally mushroomed into the Silvio Berlusconi fascist coalition government that rules Italy today. In order to see what became of the Cagoulard and to see the evolution of the Cagoulard movement into, first of all, the Vichy, well, into the fascist fifth column that helped to effect Hitler's conquest of France, and later into the Vichy collaborationist government with which François Mitterrand was very close, François Mitterrand, of course, the current, quote, socialist, unquote, prime minister of France, an individual who was deeply involved with the political milieu of the Cagoulard. The next book that we're going to turn to in order to see what became of the Cagoulard movement or how it evolved into the Vichy collaborationist government that ruled France after the German conquest, it basically ruled France as a proxy government for the Germans, we're going to turn to a book from the same basic historical period as Joseph Gollum's Army of Spies from 1939. This book was written by Pierre Coe, who was actually the Minister of Aviation in the Social Front of Léon Blum. He also stood trial in one of the political trials that the Vichy government held for many of the main figures of the Social Front. Again, Pierre Coe was actually a minister. He was a member of the government of Léon Blum's Social Front, and specifically he was deeply involved with running the French aviation and the French Air Force in particular. Indeed, Pierre Coe wrote a book called L'Armée de l'Air, The Army of the Air, in 1938, in which he proposed the revamping of France's air forces into a more modern alignment that would be more capable of dealing with the Luftwaffe. Pierre Coe wrote a very important and largely unknown book in 1944 about the role of the French fascists and the Cagoulard and their associates in the subversion of France. And Pierre Coe not only described the Cagoulard movement itself, again that abortive fascist coup attempt of 1937 and 38 in France, he also described how the French fascists collaborated with the Germans to effect the defeat of France in World War II, and then how members of the Cagoulard movement, members of the Fifth Column movement, moved into positions of power with the Vichy government. Piako's book about the Kagura movement and about the role of the French fascists in subverting France during the German attack of 1940. His book was called is called The Triumph of Treason. Again, the author was Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T. The book was published in hardcover in 1944 by Ziff Davis Publishing Company of Chicago and New York. And the first section of Pierre Cot's The Triumph of Treason that we're going to look at concerns his description of the Kagular coup movement of 1937 and 38. And again, François Mitterrand was very close to the members of that movement and remained on good terms with many of its leaders after its formal collapse. And as we shall see, we're going to take a look at what happened to those leaders. Pierre Cot writes of the Kagular affair, "A majority of the French bourgeoisie unwillingly resigned itself to fascism, which offended its liberal traditions. A powerful minority, however, adopted fascism with enthusiasm as a means of fighting the Republic. Much information and research will be needed to determine to what degree the military and political defeat of France was caused by the conspiracy of this fascist minority. What has already been demonstrated is that such a conspiracy existed. It was created before the war and was used by Hitler to smash French resistance. It culminated in the dictatorship of Maréchal Pétain. It has been carried on by fascist organizations in France and in North Africa to prevent the French people from recovering political freedom in the event of an Allied victory. The conspiracy against the Republic was discovered in November of 1937. Resuming with Pierre Cot's text in The Triumph of Treason, the conspiracy against the Republic was discovered in November of 1937. During 1936 and 1937, more and more outrages had occurred all over France. Bombs had exploded, caches of arms had been found, anti-fascist refugees had been assassinated. After each crime wave, the police uncovered more threads of an important plot. An inquiry was ordered. Many arrests were made. According to a communique of the Ministry of the Interior on November 19, 1937, quote, "The documents seized showed that the conspirators were bent on substituting for the Republican form of government a dictatorial regime which was to precede the restoration of the French monarchy," unquote. The conspiracy became known as the Kagular Plot. The Kagular, or Hooded Men, had formed a powerful secret association organized on the Hitlerian model by the most dynamic elements of the fascist organizations. To quote again from the official communique, the plotters had collected, quote, "a large quantity of war materiel, in large part of foreign origin," unquote. They had, quote, A military setup patterned after the services of the army. Their adherents were grouped into divisions, brigades, regiments, battalions, etc., with a complete general staff and a medical corps. This showed the organization's character to be prepared unquestionably for civil war," unquote. Among the leaders of the Kagular were representatives of finance, industry, the army, and the aristocracy, such as General Dusseneur, Commandant Lustalo Lacau, a collaborator and friend of Maréchal Pétain, Duke Pozzo di Borgio, Viscount de Douville-Maillefeu, Baron H. Pastre, Monsieur Eugène de Loncle, Moreau de la Muse, and others. The discovery of the Kagular plot aroused strong feelings among the people. It was clear that the French fascists were preparing to imitate the Spanish fascists by waging a civil war with assistance from abroad. The connections between the French Kagular and the German, Italian, and Spanish organizations were proved not only by the origins of their armaments, but by unequivocal documents and by the pattern of their activities. Thus, the Kagular executed a series of crimes and acts of sabotage planned in agreement with Franco: bombs of trains or materiel destined for Republican Spain, the attack on a loyalist submarine in the port of Brest, etc. Moreover, one of the Kagular leaders was a Baron Potters, P-O-T-T-E-R-S, of Austrian origin, who called himself Baron de Potier after Laval naturalized him in 1935, and who, according to the French intelligence service, was connected with Colonel Nicolai, the chief of Hitler's espionage services. The Kagular were subsidized by the great financial and economic organizations and were in touch with high military figures, among them Weygand and Pétain. The Kagular plot was the French version of the Franco insurrection. This was in 1937. In 1940, the Kagular formed the staffs of Pétain's new regime, that was the Vichy regime. In 1942, when the chances for a Nazi victory began to dissipate, certain leaders of the Cagoule went to Algiers and shipped into the, and slipped into the political entourage of the honest and patriotic General Giraud, an entourage which included authentic fascists, former members of the Vichy government like Peyrouton and General Bergeret, but very few Democrats. Having practiced the policy of collaboration with Hitler in order to defeat democracy, the Cagoulards now experimented with a policy of collaboration with the democratic powers in order to keep the French people in servitude. For the Cagoulards are interested in neither the victory of Germany nor the victory of the Allies. They have but one aim, the defeat of French democracy. I would note that the switching sides from the fascist to the Allied side by many of the Cagoulards in 1942 in many ways mirrors the reversal of political polarities that François Mitterrand himself underwent, moving from the fascists to the resistance in 1943. Continuing. The story of the Cagoulards permits us to touch on the moral and intellectual corruption of the French middle class. The Cagoule was the most dynamic expression of the bourgeoisie's conversion to fascism. It was fascism in its purest form, totally unscrupulous, ready to commit any crime and to form any alliance, be it one with Hitler, to reach its goal. But the evil was both older and deeper. The Cagoule was only one of its most visible symptoms. Skipping down, the adhesion of the reactionary bourgeoisie to fascism was thus the decisive element in the French defeat. It was the cause of causes, the common denominator for the factors of the defeat. It provoked the panic fear of communism, which prevented France from continuing in the direction of a rapprochement with Russia. It aroused a kind of conservative chauvinism in military circles, which prevented the French army from becoming a modern army. Men like Pétain and Weygand, W-E-Y-G-A-N-D, instead of concentrating, or it might be Weygand, I'm not sure, but I'm going to pronounce it Weygand, instead of concentrating on preparations for the war, thought in terms of a coup d'etat. It infused the French bourgeoisie with an admiration for Hitler that engendered the fifth column. The Cagoulards were the principal agents of this conversion. They not only professed to, but actually did, prefer Hitler to Léon Blum. And as indicated here by Pierre Coe in The Triumph of Treason, the Cagoulard coup movement, basically a group of French fascists working to overthrow French democracy, and doing so basically with the pivotal assistance of Germany and Italy, the Cagoulard eventually evolved into a formal fascist fifth column collaborationist movement, which had a great deal to do with actually subverting France during the course of the Nazi invasion. The French lost the war militarily in 1940 due to a combination of incompetence. The French military thinkers were opposed to many of the military concepts, such as the revamping of the Air Force proposed by Pierre Coe, or the revamping of French armor into armored divisions along the German model as proposed by then Colonel General de Gaulle. Some of this, no doubt, was merely sincere blundering and backwards thinking. Some of it also, equally doubtlessly, was due to conscious subversion on the part of many of the fifth columnists. Many of them had been part of the Cagoulard fascist movement. Many of them went on to not only subvert France in the face of the German invasion, but went on to become key members of the Vichy collaborationist fascist government, with which François Mitterrand was very cozy. Of the fifth column and the sympathy on behalf of the French reactionaries for fascism, which they saw as an ideal antidote to the threat or the perceived threat of socialism, Pierre Coe writes as follows. The activity of the fifth column will not be considered by historians as a special phenomenon of French public life, but as an integral part of fascism. The fifth column has appeared wherever fascism has tried to gain a foothold. It was at work in Spain, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before it turned up in France, and there are fifth columns in the United States, India, and Latin America. By the fifth column, I do not mean only spies and licensed traitors. The fifth column includes all who, by accepting fascist doctrines or methods, become the conscious or unconscious accomplices of a foreign power. Treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. The general staff of the Fifth Column consists principally of ambitious men who try to seize power by destroying or paralyzing the democratic system. The body of the Fifth Column is composed of people who think they are saving their country from the, quote, communist menace, unquote, or from, quote, British imperialism, unquote, and who do not even know in whose favor their actions are operating. Through hate of the Popular Front, good Frenchmen, or men who consider themselves such, served Hitler gratuitously by doing work to which they would never have consented had they been offered payment. Why? Because they detested the Republic and democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the, quote, Judeo-Masonic, unquote, influence and Europe from the communist peril. These people, who had never read Marx, considered the, quote, Marxist danger, unquote, more immediate than the Hitlerian. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of, quote, collaboration with Hitler's new order, unquote. The history of the Fifth Column in France before, during, and after the armistice of June 1940 cannot be written for some years to come. The trial of the Fifth Column is the trial of treason for which the French people will inevitably demand. Enough evidence has been published already to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new Saint George who would slay the communist dragon. When Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, quote, "We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic," unquote. When Elie Bois, former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939 to 1940 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a, quote, government of authority, unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory. When Anatole de Monzy writes in a book passed by the censor of the Vichy government that Maréchal Pétain said in February of 1940, quote, "They will appeal to me in the third week in May," unquote. When Genevieve Toubouy tells of the work accomplished in the Parisian salons by the Fifth Column's Brigade Mondaine, when Henri de Carilis, former officer and nationalist deputy, exposes the inroads of the Fifth Column in the conservative and military circles which he knew, when Henri Torres reveals to us what was going on in the office of the official propaganda, we have every reason to accept their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events. On the eve of the war, in a series of articles published in L'Europe Nouvelle, Georges Bidault demonstrated with striking documents how the French fascist press was carrying out the orders of the German propagandists. At the same time, the government had been driven by revelations published in L'Humanité to expel Otto Abetz, A-B-E-T-Z, the director of Fifth Column activities in France. No one, of course, can base a definitive judgment against specific persons on these affirmations or revelations. But in the most serious works on the French defeat, in four books of scientific value written by men of unquestionable intellectual honesty, Jacques Maritain, Yves Simon, Albert Guérard, and Pertinax, André Giraud, I find the same impression. France was betrayed. France was handed over. France was abandoned by Frenchmen who saw their savior in Hitler. And how could it have been otherwise? Why, of all the European democracies, should France have been the only one without a Fifth Column? How could Hitler have neglected to undermine France's resistance before throwing his armies against her? No, France received no exceptional treatment from Hitler and fascism. A general plan coordinated the activity of the Fifth Columns all over the world. All were recruited from the same circles and had the same social and political composition. The object was the same everywhere, to divide and unnerve public opinion, weaken the resistance of the regime, and prepare a governmental group ready to execute a fascist coup d'etat at a moment of trouble or confusion. The methods were the same everywhere. Cultivation of the seeds of disunity which normally exist among free men and in free countries, exaggeration and inflammation of all racial and religious conflicts, all class rivalries, all political antagonisms, gradual conversion of opposition and dissent into hate, creation of an atmosphere of civil war. The means used were the same everywhere. Campaigns of calumny against the democratic leaders capable of opposing fascism, Blum in France, Roosevelt in the United States, the development of anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is the first manifestation of racism and contains in petto the whole doctrine of Hitler, use of the fear of communism among the middle classes, because anti-communism is the best way to prevent the union of all anti-fascist forces. This last device has been the most efficacious. The fear of communism has become, in European and American politics of recent years, a much more important factor than communism itself. This, by the way, written in 1944, and I'd have to say that this is about as prophetic as anything I've come across. Pierre Coe, again, writing in 1944, "The means used were the same everywhere. Campaigns of calumny against the democratic leaders capable of opposing fascism, Blum in France, Roosevelt in the United States, the development of anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is the first manifestation of racism and contains in petto the whole doctrine of Hitler, use of the fear of communism among the middle classes, because anti-communism is the best way to prevent the union of all anti-fascist forces. This last device has been the most efficacious. The fear of communism has become, in European and American politics of recent years, a much more important factor than communism itself." Recall now, interrupting briefly, in Radio Free America number 37, I described how the Nazis learned to use anti-communism, the fear of communism, as a strategic device for effecting the conquest of the nations that they had targeted for being overrun. The French collaborationists of the Fifth Column, of the Cagoule, the Cagoulard, and of the Vichy collaborationist government of Maréchal Pétain, the government with which François Mitterrand was so cozy, that is an excellent example of how the Nazis were able to use the fear of communism to their own ends and to effect conquest. Now, many of the industrialists and financiers and politicians who were pro-fascist and who participated in the Cagoulard coup attempt and who collaborated with the Fifth Column fared quite well under Hitler. Many of them also went on to feed post-World War II French fascism. We should note, however, that as we saw in Radio Free America number 37, the French fascists of the Cagoule and of the Fifth Column and of the Vichy collaborationist government had their counterparts here in the United States as well. And in Radio Free America 37, I set forth my working hypothesis that the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit was basically a Trojan horse, literally a projection into the United States of the German General Staff and of the Third Reich's National Security Establishment, that it allied with political forces in the United States that were of the same basic viewpoint as the fascist collaborationist forces in France, of which François Mitterrand was a part, which led those forces having given rise to the Cagoule, to the Fifth Column, and to the Vichy government itself. And it is my considered opinion that the assassination of President Kennedy, our other political assassinations, and a great many other things that have befallen the United States in the post-World War II period are symptomatic of the same sort of program at work here in the United States that the Cagoulard were setting forth in France in the pre-World War II period. And I think the end effect of the interaction between the Gehlen organization and forces in the United States of the same viewpoint as the Cagoulard and the Vichy collaborationists, the interaction between the two is going to bring the United States, or to a large extent has already brought the United States, to its knees. And I feel that if those forces are not negated, and I don't think they're going to be, then the effect for the United States is going to be at least as disastrous as the Panzer divisions crossing the borders of France and subjugating France.